This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. On the program today, we're going to talk about children's literature. Thousands of new books for children are published every year. Some are very good, some not so good. We're going to talk this afternoon about children's literature. We'll talk about good books for children, books I suspect that will also appeal to adults. Two guests join me in the studio this afternoon. They are Elaine Bearden and Deborah Stevenson. Deborah Stevenson is an assistant professor in the Graduate School of Library Science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And Elaine Bearden is the children's librarian at the Urbana Free Library. And I just learned that she spent the morning dressed as a moon. We'll ask her about that in just a moment. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guests. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. By the way, beginning next month, once a month here on the Afternoon Magazine, we're going to have a feature on children, reading, and literature. We'll talk with noted and respected experts from our community in the field of language, literature, and literacy, people like Elaine Bearden and Deborah Stevenson. These interviews will follow the closing market report on the first Monday of the month. Next month, that Monday is the 4th of June, so we hope you will tune in. Meantime, I do hope you'll join us this afternoon with a telephone call. Do you wonder what you can do to encourage reading? Do you wonder how you can help the children in your life select good books? Do you have suggestions for us? What books have you and your family enjoyed together? Please join us. Give us a call this afternoon. Questions and comments are invited. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. You spent the morning dressed as a moon at the Urbana Free Library.
That's right. It's time for summer reading. Uh-huh. And one of the things we do at the Urbana Library is go into the schools to promote the summer reading program. So next week, starting Monday morning, we'll be going to assemblies in each of the 6 elementary schools. And the summer reading program theme this year is Mission Read to the Library and Beyond. So the librarians are going as celestial bodies, shall we say.
So you are the moon.
I'm the moon. The sun will also be appearing, as well as the earth.
Okay. And stars, you all are.
That's right.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about the reading program, the summer reading program at the Urbana Free Library.
There are two parts to the summer reading program. First of all, the kids can come to the library and sign up for an independent reading club, which means they read 10 books and they get a prize of either a gift certificate worth $6 from Pages for All Ages bookstore or a free book. And then they can continue reading throughout the summer. Every 5 more books they read, they can get in a raffle for prizes at the end of the summer. For pre-readers, we have a program where for every 5 books read to them, they get a sticker. And then in addition to the independent reading clubs, all summer they can come to programs we have throughout the summer. One we're really excited about this year is it's called the Book Waves Read Aloud. The kids are going to come every Thursday in June and July, hear selections from chapter books read aloud. Then we're going to talk about their favorite books, and they'll hear about a chance to go on television to talk about their favorite books.
Wow. More stars. More stars are born. Well, are these programs at libraries common? And so if people are listening outside of Urbana, could they go to Champaign or Rantoul, or would there be programs in Bloomington Normal and the like?
The summer reading programs are everywhere. It's a big thing in children's departments. The idea is to keep kids reading during the summer when they're outside of school, so they don't lose what they learn during the school year. So, and for some kids who haven't learned how to read yet, it's opportunities and incentives to begin reading, to try that hard work of reading and creating a positive association with books.
Okay, let's bring Deborah Stevenson into the conversation. Now, when did the first books written specifically for children begin to appear? What was the beginning of the children's department at the library?
Well, those are sort of two different questions, and it also depends, of course, on how you're defining a children's book. If you're talking about children's books designed to be read for pleasure by the child, the date that most people go to is the mid-18th century when John Newbery, and the Newbery Medal for the American Library Association is named after John Newbery. Now, one of the interesting things is, of course, the first book that John Newbery produced was actually a book and toy combination. So that goes back for a long time. He was a very smart marketer. I'm very fond of John Newbery. He's a great figure. But the actual children's library movement is much more a late 19th century movement. I suspect Elaine might have a better grasp of that history than I do in many ways. And then children's divisions in publishing companies in America started happening in the beginning of the 20th century, many of those former librarians or people who worked very closely with librarians. So the production of children's books and the children's library, children's departments and libraries have always been very closely tied together.
Now, do you want to say something about the children's library, the children's department at the library, how it got its start?
Well, oftentimes it was in the basement of public libraries that the children's libraries got started, and it has a little bit to do with the idea of knowledge growing up and beyond. We laugh that maybe it's just they don't want to hear the noise, but but I think a sense of, you saw a lot of library growth on the late 1900s. You've got a lot of immigrant families coming into the United States, and you saw that up in Chicago with the Hull House, and just an interest in creating opportunities for children to learn and to get excited to better themselves, really. I mean, they had clean hand washing clubs and all kinds of, kind of a socialization, and that has progressed over the years, and now our role is much broader than that.
Yeah. Deborah, that book that Newbery wrote that came with the toy, what was it about and what was the toy?
It was called A Little Pretty Pocket Book, and it came with a pincushion for girls and a top for boys. Newbery also did periodicals. He had subscribers in the U.S. even then. He had some fabulous science books about Tom Telescope and Tom Telescope's adventures. He was the publisher of Goody Two-Shoes. He turns up in a lot of references in literature for written by adults, as well as literature for children. Of course, that was written by adults, too, because he was such a big figure in the 18th century publishing. Publishers were both the press people and the editors at that point. And always also often a financial consolation to their usually needy writers. So Oliver Goldsmith, who may have written Goody Two-Shoes, gives a tip of his hat to John Newbery in one of his other books, basically in return for being loaned money. So they were very much then as they are now, activist figures running around always looking for something interesting to publish and wondering what's going on and what will sell and what are people interested in. And there's different degrees of that still today.
Yeah. So there were genres, there were different books of interest for different genres right from the outset. Fiction, kind of how to grow up, or maybe we could call that self-help.
Conduct books would
conduct
be the period name.
Books.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Very good. Fiction, science, music. Poetry?
Definitely, all of those. There was much more religious-based writing for children in that era, but one of the reasons why that era stands out is there's also plenty of secular material. But early poets like Isaac Watts, who, if people know of him, mostly they know of his poems from Alice in Wonderland, where they get parodied. And, of course, that happens to so many writers that you end up knowing the parodies better than the original. But the other thing that changed importantly for contemporary children's literature is in the late 19th century when they really started perfecting color reproduction to make some really lovely illustrations in books. And then the ideas we have about picture books, that the art and the text would work together in a harmonious whole, those are notions that arose in that period with mainly one particular publisher as well. So names like Randolph Caldecott, who is another name familiar to us now from an award, Kate Greenaway, Walter Crane, are from that era, and they've essentially defined our understanding of picture books.
Yeah. In your experience, for both of you, this question, what is it that makes a book or a story appealing to children?
I would say that for a child, something that relates to either their cognitive development, their social development, their emotional development, something that reflects the life they are living right now. I think that makes a big, either the life they're living or on some emotional level, what's going on. I mean, I think you see that with, for example, the Beverly Cleary Ramona series, which started being published, I believe, back in the 60s or maybe 50s. Mm-hmm. And more recently, her last series entries in those. But I think one of the reasons those books were so popular with children were that, and still today, to some extent, is because it relates to the emotional life of the child. You know, some of the, you know, there's no computers that show up in the books, but it's still the same issues. You know, does my mom love me as much as she loves my sister? Things like that. And those books in particular didn't get a lot of attention from critics. But Cleary finally did, I believe, win the Newbery for a later book. And she also received a Lifetime Achievement Award. But I think books like that that relate to where a child is or is feeling or can relate to is what defines, in some ways, good children's literature. There's, of course, the whole quality issue as well. And I think those two sides are at constant tension at the table. I know that when I was reviewing at the Bulletin, which Deborah is an editor of, that was on the table every week. You know, this is a quality book, but does it have an audience? This has appeal, but it's not a quality book. So I think the best books are probably the ones that meld those two together that can stand the test of time. Hmm.
Yeah, it can be an interesting balance. I mean, to some extent, I think of a book as a delivery system. And I totally agree with what Elaine is saying about the appeal of a book that speaks to a kid's experience. But I also think that there are a lot of books that are capable of making an experience that is very different from a reader's life vivid enough that the kid can connect with it. And I think that's the kind of connection that we're always hoping for. I also want to toss a monkey wrench in the works and say we're all very aware of that, of course, kids like adults are not monoliths. And there are some kids that will find one kind of book, a kind they always connect with, and other kids will be left cold by that. And that's one of the challenges, that surefire books for every single kid are rare, if not impossible. I mean, I'm sure Elaine knows several of them, and I see several in the pile that I would suspect are good for a large majority. But we also, I think, would support the notion that specialized tastes are not bad tastes, and that one of the interesting things when you're a parent or a relative or a friend or working with a child one-on-one is you can really explore an individual's taste and watch a child's interests blossom in their own specific and personal way.
Yeah. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us now. So let's go to the phones and talk with a caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to say our kids didn't read. We read voraciously. Our son told us why he didn't read, because he said, you and Mom read so much that we decided we couldn't compete. And anyway, do you have any suggestions about been the biggest disappointment of my life for my kids not to read? But I'm 71, and I wanted to hear your answer to this question. How do you get kids to read when they don't want to read and they want to do something else?
Okay. That's a question I'm sure that a lot of listeners can relate to.
I think that's a really tough question, and I hear parents from all walks of life dealing with it every day. And I don't think there is one right answer. I mean, I think you've given your children a wonderful gift, reading aloud to them. And, you know, whether they revisit that with their own children and hearing your voices in their head and, you know, in their heads, or run across a book in a bookstore that they remember, you know, I think that's a gift in itself. We had a man in the library yesterday looking for a book that he remembered his mother reading aloud. She was had now passed away, but he was very intent on wanting to find this book, and it was Nibble Nibble Mousekin, illustrated by Joan Walsh Angland, and he was thrilled to find it. But I think that's a question that all parents deal with. We talk about creating an environment for books, having books in the home, making visits to the library, the bookstores. But it's, you know, it comes down to the child's choice at some point, too.
I also think that across the board, there is less reading of books, especially, than there used to be, because there's more other media competing with it. This is something that discussed especially in young adult librarianship, that, for instance, magazines count as reading, and that there's a lot of emphasis on, even though they are ephemeral, that they are something that young adult patrons really like to read. This probably isn't much help to you with your grown-up children, of course, but I do think that it's not necessarily that a specific – sometimes, of course, there are specific children who have difficulty reading. I'm not arguing with that. But that sometimes that what children are absorbing is not books. They're absorbing – you know, they're surfing the net. They're reading magazines. They're reading things that don't look the same as books. And I would totally understand and totally support the notion that books offer something that those other media don't, but that I think it's increasingly a challenge, and it's increasingly a challenge that adults necessarily aren't meeting, to find the time to sit down with books in the way that perhaps was slightly more common before all those other electronic and plugged-in things came on the scene.
Yeah. I think we've got another call coming in. No, we don't. Okay. Other calls are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. I remember as a kid, it was a great, big, wonderful thing when you were old enough to have your library card in your back pocket. That was so special. And then you could do, you could go by yourself to the children's department, or you could go with mom or dad and see what they were interested in. So that was another way that I think my parents really got us to be readers. And also, it was important, I think, for them to have a house full of books and magazines. So there was always something to read, and people were always reading something, even if it was the back of the cereal box.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, going back to the idea of reading choices, you know, my brother and I have talked about, he doesn't consider himself a reader, and we grew up in the same house. I said, what's up with that? I said, you used to inhale tennis magazine and bicycling magazine when we were in high school. But he wasn't seeing that as reading, you know, and certainly that's an important form of reading. You know, I have another friend who reads car repair manuals for fun. And that's his reading. I certainly don't want to read that, but and he doesn't like novels, and I love novels. So I think different, especially with the changes in technology that Deborah was referring to, that reading is taking different forms.
Mm. And a lot of people who, and when I say people, I'm definitely including kids, who like to read the one form don't necessarily read it exclusively either. I like to read cookbooks. I like to read gardening books. Yeah, so I'll read a lot of things that aren't cookbooks and gardening books. So I think going back also to the what will appeal to a kid, I think sometimes there's a little concern about a kid's liking a book that doesn't look very serious. Well, I don't think adults are always reading things very serious either. And sometimes I think we want kids to read the way we think we ought to be reading rather than the way we actually do read.
Yeah, I think, you know, comic books are fine. Right? That's something to read. That's fun. It's not necessarily bad for you, right?
There's a brilliant graphic novel movement into young into children's books and young adult books right now. They're doing amazing things with it. Elaine's brought one of the best ones along. They're going down in book form for younger readers, incredibly inviting. There's also some fabulous and really inventive stuff for older readers, including some imports from other countries like Lat's Kampung Boy. Graphic illustrations set to 16th century narratives of Canadian exploration, a biography of Houdini, campy story of a superhero cat in the middle grades who saves people from fashion mistakes. There's really glorious work going on with the sequence visuals. It's some wonderful stuff, and I think it's very appealing to a lot of young readers.
Deborah Stevenson of the Graduate School of Library Science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign is one of our guests this afternoon. Also, Elaine Bearden, children's librarian at the Urbana Free Library. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Let's take another call. A listener on line one on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. Is concerned reluctant readers. My youngest is a boy, and he still is dyslexic. He's 28 now. But when he was in about fourth or fifth grade, I gave him a joke book, and he would carry it around and, you know, read the jokes, at, you know, ask the riddles to people. And, he, again, we don't usually think of that as reading, but it is reading. And that's something he didn't think of as reading. We thought of it as jokes. And also another thing is reading to them. And, like, he was in Title I, so when he had to read, I would read a page, he would read a page. And another thing is something like a Larson calendar, you know, with those awful jokes, cartoons on it. So there are a lot of different ways that you can kind of sneak reading in.
Yeah, and Celeste was talking about the wonderful memory of going to the library and opening up to the world of books. Not every kid views it that way. And I think you make a great point about his doing reading that he didn't think of as reading, and to some extent that's part of why he enjoyed it. It didn't seem like the homework that he felt he couldn't do. He was just reading jokes and having a good time.
Thanks for the call
this afternoon. Yeah, I think that was really exciting to me. And you know, at the library we took out joke books. We took out such a wide range of material. And, you know, it was whether or not you could carry it home was the issue. We were within walking distance, so.
We often have people asking how many books they're allowed to take home, and I usually, the limit is very high. And I said, well, it's pretty much how many you can carry home, because that's the answer.
How do librarians select books for inclusion in their collection for the children's department?
That's a great question. One of the main ways that we select books for our collection is reading through review journals. These are journals that are published once a month, sometimes twice a month. Titles like the Bulletin of the Center for Children's Books, which Deborah is editor of, Hornbook, School Library Journal, Booklist. They review thousands of books over the course of the year and give balanced reviews so that librarians can read through those and make informed decisions about books based on what books are popular, you know, what's really flying off the shelves, what curriculum needs there might be, what looks interesting, what books have just been published by authors that people love, what's the Newbery or Caldecott that have just come out. That's one of our main ways. I think all of us also just try to keep a pulse on the culture and see what's going on. Sometimes I go to the bookstore to see what they have out on their shelves. Other things, going to Amazon, seeing what's the most popular. There's just all kinds of ways. But the main way is really using review journals, because it helps you kind of sort through the marketing that's so prevalent with the book world and really get to quality things or items that you think your patrons just really want.
Okay, that's a big job. It's a big part of the librarian's job. If you're an adult trying to find a book as a gift for a child, or some, you know, a couple of books for gifts, you know, what's your advice, Deborah, for us is if we want to buy a gift for a child?
That can be a tough one. We actually produce a free printable, downloadable PDF in the fall of every year. That's the guidebook to gift books to help people with that. If you're lucky enough to have a good bookstore with a knowledgeable children's buyer, they can be very creative and very intuitive and very smart. The other thing you can do, and as far as I know, I've never heard a librarian complain about that, is find out some good things from the library and then go and buy them.
Go talk to someone like Elaine. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what is flying off the shelves these days, both in the library and at the bookstores?
Well, I'd have to say our graphic novel collection, which we just started last year, perhaps. And we have one particular bookcase with them, and we're constantly replacing them. It's just really amazing. I mean, it's not only booming in terms of things to buy that are available. In our department, we go up through fifth grade, and at first, we really didn't have a lot we could buy that was appropriate for fifth grade and under. But now with things like Baby Mouse, Queen of the World, which is by Jennifer L. Holm and Matthew Holm, a brother and sister team, there's really some great stuff out there. And I brought another one called Owlie, which is actually doesn't have any writing in it. It's all pictures. So you have to read the pictures to figure out what's going on in the story. And as Deborah and I were discussing before we came on air, is you can't skim these very well. It really takes your attention to figure out what's going on in the story.
Tell us a little bit about Baby Mouse, Queen of the World. What's the audience for this?
The audience for this is, I would say, third through sixth grade, depending on the sensibilities of the kids. It's pink. I mean, the book is pink, and I book talk this, and I say, now, don't let that turn you off, because some folks may be turned off by the pink. But Baby Mouse is a student, and she has these fantastic imagination and a locker that sticks. That's just kind of her life. And she, you know, her nemesis is Felicia Furry Paws, and she wants nothing better than to be invited to Felicia's birthday party. And she tries everything and finally gives Felicia her book report to turn in as her own. And then she does get that coveted invitation. Things don't turn out quite as well as she had hoped at the slumber party, though. So it's basically about a kid. Or mouse who's going through school life.
A kid and, mouse.
Yes. Going through school and, you know, sibling problems. And there's about six or seven this summer. Camp Baby Mouse is coming out, which I am anxiously awaiting.
Yeah. Deborah, you want to mention some things that are really hot right now?
Well, the graphic novel trend is probably in the forefront, and we've kind of talked about that. There is a lot moving up to middle grade and older readers. I wouldn't necessarily say Lemony Snicket inspired entirely, but the sort of things that whose popularity has been influenced by the popularity of Lemony Snicket, sort of camp and dark adventures. And there are some interesting ones of those. We're having an interesting period of strange schools. We have two books about schools for schooling child evil geniuses to take over the world.
Is this a Rowling kind of a phenomenon?
Some of them, the schools are more less and more Hogwarts-like. And I think to some extent that the popularity of Harry Potter has paved the way for some of these books, but they're not necessarily imitative in their own right. So they'll often have similar appeals, but they're not ripoffs. They're really good books of individual imagination. Higher Institute for something evil. I don't remember what V is for. And then there's one called Evil Genius. Just right and proper, Evil Genius. Chicklet also still strongly with us. And there is no shortage of books about glamorous teenagers forced to summer in a summer colony where there are lots of attractive boys. And one of the interesting things that's happening in the Chicklet is that it's gotten interestingly multicultural and diverse. So aside from multicultural groups in a given book, there are Latinas who are wandering around looking at hot boys. There are African-American groups of girls wandering around looking at hot boys. Everybody gets to be shallow in the summer, I think, is the message here.
Yeah. Well, we know the Caldecott and Newbery Awards. Are there awards for chapter books? Are there awards for books that appeal to older kids? And another question regarding awards is how indicative are they of something that's really good?
Those are tough questions, yeah. I think, is the answer. I think every year is a little different. You know, the committees, the award committees are given their mission, you know, with their awards. Caldecott is, I think, the best combination of words and pictures. The Newbery, which is more for fourth through eighth graders, is for literature. And some years the literary appeal is high, but the popular appeal is lower. And other years, it's the opposite. And sometimes, like with a book like Lewis Sacker's Holes, they hit it where it's a book that is excellently written, high-quality literature, and also incredibly popular, even before the movie was out. You know, that was a book that I was leading a mother-daughter book group at that time, and they all chose that book as their favorite that year.
It's an interesting process. I mean, most of the awards that people know about come through the American Library Association. And it does, in fact, have awards specifically for young adults. It has the Prince Award. It also has the Alex Award, the best book written for adults that is read by young adults. It has the Theodore Seuss Geisel Award for early readers. We at the Bulletin instituted a few years ago the Griffin Award because the Newbery is starting to slant so much to older books. There are a lot of great young adult books, books that could be read really by sixth graders and up. And comparatively thin on the ground are books for second graders. And we wanted to shine more of a light on those books. So the Griffin Award is for transitional reading anywhere from kindergarten through fourth grade or just transitioning to reading a full novel on its own. And we'll include poetry. Baby Mouse was an honor book. So there are different awards for different kinds of books. And the process depends on the committee, and it depends on the guidelines they're given. But different committees will put a little more weight to different parts of the guidelines, and it also depends on the arrangement of books. Sometimes the juxtaposition of – sometimes the flaw – every book, I think, probably is flawed in some way. And sometimes flaws and merits balance out a little differently. But it's a fascinating process to be on an award committee. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line one on a cell phone. Hi. We have a caller there on line one?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay. I wonder if you could suggest a book for 9-year-old's birthday. He's rather artistic and very visual. He likes magic or jokes. He's reading the Lemony Snicket series now, and I was wondering if there's something, given the description, if you could suggest for him.
Okay, who wants to take a stab at that?
Well, two thoughts that comes to mind. Which, when you say magic, which kind of magic does he like? Does he like Houdini or the fantasy magic?
Houdini type.
There are two really good Houdini biographies. One of them is a graphic novel. I think it's called The Handcuff King, but the author is Lutes, L-U-T-E-S. And there's also another one called Escape! Exclamation point. And the author of that is Sid Fleischman, who's also written a lot of novels for young people. And he himself is actually a practicing magician. So he has a really good understanding of Houdini and what he does and also knows what he's not allowed to give away. Does that help?
Could you repeat the hand...
I think it's The Handcuff King. I'm not sure, but the author is Lutes, L-U-T-E-S, and it is a graphic novel biography of Houdini.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Other questions, comments are invited this afternoon. We're talking today about children's literature. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. What's the shelf life of children's books? What's the shelf life, say, of Baby Mouse, Queen of the World, do you think?
Well, I would say for graphic novels, time will tell.
Yeah.
For some of these. You know, some of the paperback series that we see, and we have a discussion every year, do we get rid of the Sweet Valley High books or not? Because we have the whole series. Those tend to be a shorter shelf life. They're in the moment. They might be connected with television shows, etc. Those tend to be shorter life. But some of the, well, certainly Newberry's and Caldecott's have a longer shelf life, partly because they're going to be in print. I mean, that's a big difference now that books are going out of print so easily. And I think as books are connected with curriculum, teachers who latch onto certain books for use in the classroom, that tends to make a longer shelf life for books as well.
Yeah. Speaking of out of print, are there titles that are in danger of fading away that might be forgotten, that shouldn't be forgotten?
Almost certainly, I think, is the answer to that. There's a fair amount of discussion, and has been for a long time, about the death of the middle list, the death of the mid-list author, that basically publishing is increasingly a very expensive and very corporatized business. Most of the publishers go back several levels to, you know, Gulf and Western or Bertelsmann or some big company that you may not even think of as a publisher. There was a big change in the tax laws also in the 1970s, I think it was, that they used to be able to take some relief from the cost of keeping the books in storage, that they were, that was to some extent write-offable, I make up a word here, so that they, it didn't cost them to keep books in storage, to warehouse them. And now it does. So they can't afford just to print them and leave them around in the hopes that they'll sell over the next 10 years. They really need to earn back their money pretty much most years they make, which makes it a tougher call. I don't think I could identify a book necessarily. Elaine has talked about how awards pretty much are preserving a book in aspic for all eternity. But it is just a sad fact of contemporary publishing that a smaller niche audience is often not enough to keep a book going. But they also will bring things back. The Edward Eger just got reprinted a couple years ago, which is a favorite from a lot of people's childhoods, with new covers by Quentin Blake, I think, and so very contemporarily appealing. So publishers aren't averse to bringing things back if they think there's an audience for them. And you have also specialization. There's a publisher at Viking, Sharon November, who specializes in fantasy and makes a point of importing and reprinting books that she really thinks would have a good chance at a contemporary young audience.
Interesting. The books that are out there now for kids that have television tie-ins, what kind of things are we talking about? What kind of TV characters might have a book sitting in the library linked
Dora
to the show?
Dora the Explorer.
Dora the Explorer, okay.
Blue's Clues, Clifford the Big Red Dog.
Okay.
It goes on and on and on. But Dora seems to... Oh, Thomas the Tank Engine, another huge, huge one. We could have a whole library filled with Thomas the Tank Engine, and there wouldn't be enough books.
Wow. Are publishers marketing directly to kids?
I would say definitely. And in some cases, they're marketing directly to their parents who were former children. You see that with reprints of Strawberry Shortcake, Care Bears, things that weren't really great literature in the first place, but are somehow connecting with that inner child of the parents. So they buy it for their own children. But current children, television characters, it's in their cereal. One parent said their child was not exposed to television, but had Dora on the pull-ups that they bought at the grocery store, so that when they came to the library and she saw a Dora book there, she was so excited. So now she's attached to Dora. So, but she's excited about books, and you just, you know, try to put all of them in front of their faces, I think.
And it can go back and forth, too. I mean, it's interesting. A lot of people who work in illustration for children's books do end up doing cartooning. Dan Yaccarino had something, The Octopus. And I start seeing people that I had seen as artists, and I see their work jumping around on the TV screen. And also some people who write for kids in different areas, and I'm not going to think of their names, but the authors of the creators of the series Kim Possible have just written a novel for kids that my reviewer really thought was absolutely splendid and very enjoyable. So people can move the talents in both directions a lot of times. So it can be across fruition rather than just across marketing.
I think we're going to take another call now. A listener in Rantoul, line one. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to say that I agree with the concept of children identifying a hero or finding a hero, and then from that hero, they have a direction to be motivated to read. Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I think that that's what happened with my daughter when she identified her heroes. She became much more interested in reading for long periods of time because of her curiosity.
Mm. And who are her heroes?
Well, I have to brag a little bit. She's in the second grade, and she reads at a sixth grade level. And strangely enough, my little ballerina likes all-star wrestling.
Good for her. And good for you. You must be very proud.
Well, you know, I wonder if it's because she weighs 47 pounds. You know, she's not the biggest girl. And maybe those big guys are sort of her heroes because of their size in some way make her feel like, you know, that's how she'd like to be. But when we tried to find things to get her interested in reading, boy, she really took off in her... in the first grade, she jumped several grades in her reading ability from reading about wrestling, and I never dreamed that would be the case.
Well, and that's another point about kids being very individual often and what they find interesting to read about. And I think it's great that you were just happy to let her rip and she was having a good time and reading ahead and you let her be her and read what she wanted to read.
And I think it's interesting also, this is something she saw on TV. She got really excited by what she saw, you know, visually stimulated, and then it made her curious to read and to follow up and to investigate. And I think sometimes with kids, when they are young and they see something that's very visually stimulating, like Star Wars or other shows like that, that it does get them excited about reading.
Hmm. And that's certainly something a parent can participate in and say, hey, let's go and read more about this.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I'm enjoying your conversation today. Thank you for talking on these topics.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call and thanks for the compliment. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about children's books, children's literature. Two guests are with us this afternoon, Elaine Bearden of the Urbana Free Library and Deborah Stevenson of the Graduate School of Library Science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We've got a couple minutes left in this portion of the program. If you've got a question or a comment or an observation to make, we'd like to hear from you. 333-945. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, that's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Before we run out of time, who are a couple of writers that you think are underappreciated or unsung and really deserve more attention?
Well, my first thought was Kevin Hankes, but he already gets a lot of attention. But can I just talk about Kevin Hankes?
You certainly may.
Because I just think he's fantastic in terms of his growth as a writer and illustrator. He started with picture books for children, writing and illustrating them. And the story goes he spent a lot of time in college going through children's picture books, knowing this is what he wanted to do. And he's perhaps most well known for books like Lily's Purple Plastic Purse is one that came out. But the one I have in my hand is Kitten's First Full Moon, which he actually won the Caldecott for. And it was such a change in his illustration style. And he did it all in black and white. And I think in a way, maybe that's why it was so striking, because children's picture books are almost exploding with color and mm-hmm. action. He's also moved into chapter books, and he's been doing this for a while, and he's putting out some very excellent stories, most recently Olive's Ocean, about a middle school student and kind of growing up in her family. I think Kevin has quite a good following already, but I had to speak about him.
Yeah, he got a wonderful review in the May 13th New York Times, where the reviewer just said, "This guy is getting better all the time. Getting better all the time" mm-hmm. is the headline, and the new book is A Good Day, which just sounds like a beautiful book. Deborah's nodding. You're nodding your head. Do you want to?
It's a lovely book. One of the nice things about both Kitten's First Full Moon, which Betsy Hearn, by the way, from the library school here, was the chair of that Caldecott committee that gave it the award, and A Good Day, is they're accessible to very young children, 2-3 years old. And a lot of picture books are, and there are many of them splendid picture books for, say, 5 years old through 8 years old. I think that a lot of people are drawn to the slightly more sophisticated picture book viewing audience, and I think it is takes a little bit more discipline to write for under fours, and it's really exciting, I think, that he's doing more of that.
Mm. Let's take one more call before we're out of time. Line one, Champaign, hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm so glad. I have several questions, quick ones, I think, and comments. I'm so glad that Kevin Hink is came up, because he is terrific. He's just like hands down. I think his books they're very funny, but they're very wise in terms of emotion and feeling. So I just wanted to add that to what you said, and also ask you, have you ever tried to get him to be a visiting author at the library?
We have not. Generally, the money required to bring somebody like that is quite a lot. I've heard him at conferences, mm-hmm. and but that's something that at least we haven't explored at the library.
I didn't know if he'd have any like loyalty to regional libraries.
Right.
We're a few hundred miles away from Madison, but I thought, oh, maybe, you know.
Right.
It is cheaper to get people from closer.
There would be a way to combine resources, because I think he'd be wildly popular.
Oh, I think so, too. And also, I think he would probably do excellent school assemblies, too, you know, and connecting with kids. He's just a very wonderful human being, too.
Right, we did. We talked about trying to get him for Dr. Howard, but we didn't know if we'd have the resources. And I'm just reminded that I should look into it again,
mm-hmm.
to see what our options are for combining, you know,
yes.
resources. So, okay. Well, good. Yeah, a favorite. So glad he came up. My question is, my daughters loved Cobble Street Cousins.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my daughters is still at the age where she can read them on her own. Is there anything, do either of the guests know if there's anything similar by Cynthia Ryland? I don't think, we know a lot of her stuff, for anybody else, real similar in terms of the level, reading level and the content, because they're really sweet books.
Right, those are stories about the cousins who live in their aunt's attic, right? And they their parents are traveling the world. And the girls kind of have their own, they create their own business and they create their own newspaper. And it's illustrated by a Wendy Halperin, I think.
Wendy Anderson.
Yeah, Wendy Anderson Halperin. That particular area of books has really increased. The numbers of books in that particular reading level has really increased. You know, I'm not thinking of any that have that kind of interplay with the kids, but one of my favorite new books in that same reading level is Akimbo and the Elephants. This is a children's book written by an adult author who's actually doing quite a good job, Alexander McCall Smith. And it's about a boy in Africa whose father is a game warden at a wildlife park. And so he gets to interact with the animals. And just very well written, great sketches throughout. And what child wouldn't love their parent to be in charge of all of the animals?
Yeah, that sounds great. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. I want to thank Elaine Bearden of the